Spirit Blade Underground, episode 384. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 384.
Podcast. We've got Amadeon, Biblicon, Sam, Shay, Tech, Geeka, Tam, Blah. Boy, I hope this isn't your first episode, because you're not going to know what's going on. I'm tired. Is anybody else tired? Good gravy. Peter Franson here, from the Spirit Blade and God Productions, producing entertainment resources to equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ. A little harder when you're tired to live intentionally, isn't it? Info free goodies, spiritblade.com. This is the monitor room. Spirit Blade on the Grand Parade. Blade of the Celebration, Geekery, Geek Out of Town, Fish Pockets, Chris, Chicago's website, and community checkout.com. On the show today, reviews of both Crimson Peak and The Last Witch Hunter, which I recorded before I was this tired, so those will have a lot more energy in them. All right, let's go. Here we do. Okay, kiddo, pop quiz time. Best movie franchise.
The Terminator.
Not even close. The Matrix. Best TV show.
Star Trek.
What? Farscape. You have to know that it's Farscape. It's like you're not even my son. Unless you're not my son.
I don't like your voice. It irritates me.
Hey, wait.
Let's make another call.
No, please.
And another, and another, and another. You are very messy. Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay, so, Crimson Peak, Guillermo del Toro's latest movie, takes place during the Industrial Revolution. By the way, I'm Peter Franson, ChristianGeekCentral.com. I forgot to say that, in Spirit Blade Productions. So this is my uncut review of Crimson Peak. During the Industrial Revolution, Edith is an aspiring young female writer who is enchanted by the affections of a mysterious English landowner named Thomas. Despite the concerns of those around her, she goes away with Thomas and his eerie sister Lucille to live in their decrepit mansion on Crimson Peak in England. While there, she begins experiencing haunting encounters with ghosts and begins to suspect that Thomas is not the man he claimed to be. All right, so this is going to be a spoiler-free review because largely there's a big mystery in this, and that's, you know, whether or not who is Thomas? What's going on with him? Can he be trusted? Is he good or bad or whatever, you know? And so the nature of the mystery of the mansion and Thomas and his sister, I'm just going to, you know, keep that off the table as much as I can. The movie starts out with some brief supernatural horror and sets up the idea of ghosts and this being kind of a ghost story, and then it settles into Pride and Prejudice for a bit. It's similar to Guillermo del Toro's Pan's Labyrinth in that this is a fairy tale mashed up with supernatural horror. But it leans more, I think, on the fairy tale side than Pan's Labyrinth did, especially when it comes to story and characters, how the story is treated, how the characters are represented. The romance side didn't work for me because the characters felt too shallow and not complex enough, and Edith unrelatably foolish in the choices that she made. Characters are also not very just complex in general, and they have motives that are hard to understand or relate to. I mean, they're motives that we're familiar with, but I just don't understand why these characters want these certain things or care about, you know, these certain things. And especially, you know, at the end when the motives become more clear, it's like, okay, well, I've seen these kinds of motives before, but I don't know. It just doesn't seem. It's they're strange and they're, you know, weird, and I couldn't relate to really anybody in this movie. As I mentioned, Edith, she is overly foolish, and as a female protagonist, you know, that maybe that works in like a horror movie setting, but for some reason I wasn't willing to forgive that here. Maybe it was because I was watching it that, you know, I've just seen too many like romantic comedies where these people are just making stupid choices, and that's why their relationship isn't working, because they're idiots, you know, and I'm just tired of seeing people, you know, getting into problems in their relationships and having trust issues or whatever, you know, because they've put themselves in that situation. Edith, in regards to love, is she's an idiot. She's just foolish. I mean, the big mystery is whether or not Thomas is a good or a bad guy, and I'm not going to spoil that, but I mean, Edith is foolish for positioning herself to have to even wonder about that. By the time you get to the point in the relationship that she's at with Thomas, you shouldn't be having those kinds of questions. You should have gotten to know this person and their past deeply before you commit to them with your life in the way that Edith has. When truth and motives are finally revealed, it felt anticlimactic to me and not surprising or unique enough to really warrant keeping them a secret for the whole movie. The suspense horror side of things also didn't work for me very much because of the pace and the use of CG over practical effects. Pan's Labyrinth. Now, they did use CG in Pan's Labyrinth, but they used a lot of practical stuff as well. And so and that has to do with motion capture. That's what it really comes down to. When you see, like, one of the creatures moving that's a guy in a suit, you know, there's just kind of a jitteriness, an imperfection to the movement that is just unsettling because you recognize it as moving organically and real, and, like, you're just creeped out by it. But CG, because motion capture just can't capture the really minute details of human or biological movement, it just looks a little bit too fluid to my eyes, you know? And I was disappointed in the amount of CG that was used to represent the creatures and stuff. And so that downscaled the creep factor for me that I think I normally would have in a movie that comes from this director. So that was a bit of a bummer. But I think also just kind of the pacing in general, it's a mystery in many ways, or it's paced like a mystery. You know, I said it's got a blend of like horror and fairy tale, and it's got some romance in there too, but it feels more like a mystery, you know, like I was engaged, I guess, more like inquisitively than I was emotionally. I was like, what is going on here? This is really mysterious, you know, and trying to just figure out what was going on. But the suspense part, I wasn't really on the edge of my seat very often. There were some jump scares, but I didn't find this to be a very scary movie. It was tense at times, but that was mostly due to the shocking brutality of those intense moments. The story logic fails at times in favor of aesthetic, as I think, you know, classic fairy tales do. You can pick apart fairy tales, and people say, why would you pick apart a fairy tale? You know, why even bother, you know? So I guess if you go into this and you say, this is a fairy tale, this is a fairy tale, then someone like me, you know, who's going to watch this and go, yeah, that person, their choice doesn't make any sense. This doesn't make any sense how this thing is working, you know. But I guess maybe because it was a blend and not solely a fairy tale, it made me feel like I should still be asking some of these questions of, well, this doesn't make sense. Why would blah, 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 you know? Like, for example, there's a giant hole in the mansion because it's decrepit and falling apart, and this in the ceiling and a few of the floors, like a big, like, train dropped out of the sky, just made holes in several floors, and it's constantly as a result, when you walk into the main room of the mansion, there's like leaves falling down during the autumn, snow falling down during the winter, you know, and I'm just thinking to myself, why is they would have to have a cleaning crew that's like constantly taking care. There'd be a huge mound of leaves with all the way the leaves are falling down in there, you know. But it looks beautiful. It's clear that they're going for something aesthetic, and they're not really worried about logic, you know. And that potentially can hurt the movie, I think, for some folks. It did a little bit for me. And you know, character choices like Edith going away to live with a man that she hardly knows anything about, seeing crazy stuff at night, and not being persistent in saying, hey, Thomas, we really do need to talk about the crazy crap that went on while you guys were asleep last night. And by the way, where were you? And da 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 da. You know, I mean, there's just questions that she does not persist in asking, and I'm just like, okay, lady, well, your fate is your own, you know? So it's a fairy tale that you just have to accept without asking the motives and decisions of characters to be relatable or to always make sense, which I found difficult because of the other story types that were blended in with this one, of which I would normally ask those kinds of questions. The purpose, I think, probably is to engage with the intended message and just not let the details and the logic and stuff get in the way. Near the beginning, there is a hint that this is not a ghost story, but actually a romance or maybe some other type of story, and the ghosts are symbolic because the main character is writing a story. She's trying to sell it to publishers as not have it be seen as a ghost story. She's like, well, there's a ghost in it, but it's not, the ghost is symbolic. And that idea is stated two times, and so I was like, okay, I think they're getting a little meta on me here and trying to set me up for what this is. Like, don't treat it like a ghost story. Like, okay, ghosts are symbolic. Good. Check. I get it. I'm ready to see the symbols and stuff. And so, you know, I think I did pick up on at least some of the symbolism that was intended, but it didn't help my emotional engagement. Really just my intellectual engagement. And I don't know if I really wanted to be intellectually engaged with a movie that has so many horror elements. I would have liked to have been emotionally engaged in a movie like this. Okay, the cast, I'm not really going to talk about the cast. A few familiar faces. They're all fine. They do a fine job, but I think they have so little to work with that they don't get a chance to really shine as performers. The stunts and visuals, I'll just talk about visuals, actually. The visuals, this is, if you see this movie, this is the reason to see it. This is a visually fantastic movie. I wouldn't be surprised if it wins an Oscar. You know, I mean, it's just haunting and dark and beautiful at the same time. I mean, it's just a visual feast. The mansion itself, the strange architecture of the mansion, all the furniture and all the objects that you're looking at that are in the mansion, the costumes, just the color choices as well, the falling leaves in the middle of the house and the snow. I mean, it looks beautiful. It looks chanting. It looks surreal. It looks like a fairy tale, you know? And so that's why you watch a movie like this, to just enjoy, I think, the visuals of all the ghost designs also. Really creepy. Despite my dislike for some of the CG, the designs themselves, I was like, yeah, that is really creepy. That's like, wow, you know, I mean, so really great stuff going on visually in this movie. That's why you would see it if you just want to have a visual experience. I don't mean like a lots of cool horror explosions and action. It's not that. But I mean, if you just want to appreciate just like these detailed, beautiful, dark, and strange visuals, I think that there's a lot to enjoy, especially in the mansion and the objects, the set of each scene. Okay, so is there anything in this movie that might spark worthwhile thought or a conversation about matters that are moral or spiritual or philosophical or whatever? I think that possibly, like I said, one of the intended themes I was able to pick up on, which is be careful who you fall in love with, you know? And again, I think this theme holds true regardless of how the movie ends and who Thomas is revealed to be. You know, she is dealing with all these problems throughout this whole movie that she shouldn't be having to deal with. And she says, you know, once or twice to Thomas, you know, I don't care about your past. I'm right here. Let's just be in the here and now. Well, you know what? The past does matter. A person's past does matter. If you're going to commit to spending the rest of your life with a person, you don't need to know every detail about their past. But I mean, the past does really matter because it informs who a person is in the present. So get to know the person you're interested in as much as possible before getting involved romantically would be my advice. I don't think that's necessarily the advice of the filmmakers, but I think the ghosts are, if they are a symbol, at least one of those symbols is, you know, the ghosts of someone's past, you know, and you're going to have to deal with those ghosts if you want to be with this person that you're romantically interested in the present. And so I think that's actually a pretty good message to walk away with. This one is rated R for bloody violence, some sexual content, and brief, strong language. If I were a time traveler, because I have no idea what your tastes are, I would go back in time and talk to myself and say, Peter, hey, Crimson Peak, been getting lots of buzz going on with that movie, but skip it. Just skip it. You'll be fine. Watch Pan's Labyrinth instead. You've got that one in your collection. That's a great movie. It's a great fairy tale horror movie that's grounded also in real human motives and real human emotions that are at least more relatable than you'll find this movie to be. This movie makes a better music video than a story. So, There you go, Pater. Save yourself a little bit of trouble. Now, I don't like numbers, but if you do, how about a 7.0 out of 10 for quality in this movie? That's about a C score, I guess. And relevance, I would give it a, let's say, 7.5 if you care about numbers. And C, again, would be kind of the range in there. Maybe a C+. I don't know. There's numbers for you. You do what you want with those. Well, I do want to remind you guys to check out the other members of the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, the Untold podcast, and POSTOS. For more info about the CGC network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com. All right, let me see if I can summon up some energy for this. The Extra Life promo, in participation with the Extra Life charity event, Christian Geek Central, as you may know already, is raising funds to provide urgent medical care for children whose parents can't otherwise afford it. There is still time to join our team, even at the last minute, guys. Some folks last year joined like the day of or like 2 weeks after. Technically, the fundraising continues on through the rest of the year, but the big kind of like event default is November 7th. But anyway, if you're unable to join our team, we want to make donating easy and fun by offering some incentives. So let me tell you a little about those. Matt McKinney of POSTOS is offering multiple incentives for supporting his fundraising efforts. For $25, Matt will apply deep cutting commentary to a Star Trek or Smallville episode of your choice. For $35, he'll do a movie or two-parter. And for $50, you can co-host an episode of POSTOS right alongside Matt and off-screen Kim. And by right alongside, I mean probably from thousands of miles away via your webcam or something. You'll work out the details with them. I had the chance to do that last year, and I had a blast. David N. Alderman of the Crossover Alliance Publishing Company is offering up a digital copy of the first Crossover Alliance anthology to anyone who donates toward his fundraising goal. That's a great way to sample the Crossover Alliance authors. If you've maybe heard a little bit about this fledgling publishing house here on the podcast or elsewhere, but you're not sure if you want to, you know, take the dive, you know, into exploring new authors and a new publisher and all that kind of business, that Crossover Alliance anthology is a great place to start and kind of get a sense of the styles of the authors. And again, a digital copy that is free when you donate toward David Alderman's fundraising efforts. Finally, I'm setting myself up once again to sing a song or play a game of your choice during my Extra Life live stream. I think last year I sang Larry's High Silk Hat from a VeggieTales video. that was a left field request. I couldn't believe it. And a song from Frozen. What was the song? Oh yeah, Let It Go. Let It Go. Oh my gosh, I hate that song. I hate everything it stands for. Except for maybe the things that are okay in it. But oh man, don't get me started on Frozen. And I think, like, I sang, my sister requested The Rhythm of the Bullets, which is the song that I wrote years ago about Wonder Woman that nobody knows about, except for maybe a few of you that have been listening to this podcast for, like, since day one or something. And then my mom requested Golgotha's Tale. That was, Mom, you embarrassed me in front of my friends. I had to do something serious. but anyway, yeah, for $25, if you're among the first five people to donate $25, you can request any pop song, any, like, you can make me sing a rap or a country song or some opera thing that I'm totally not qualified for. Well, I mean, I guess I would be qualified for maybe some with my background, but anyway, you can just force me to sing whatever terrible thing that you want, and I will give you my own special rendition of that song if I'm able to find it on iTunes to learn it there, or if I already know it. And of course, you can also select a game that I have or have access to. So anyway, $25 or more gets you that. Speaking of that live stream, which is when you'll see me sing and play those things, mark your calendar for Saturday, November 7th. That's like 2 weeks from now, guys. I cannot believe it's already coming so fast. Saturday, November 7th, 6 a.m. Pacific. Mark your calendar, 6 a.m. Pacific on November 7th. That's when I'm going to start my 24-hour video gaming marathon at ChristianGeekCentral.com and also twitch.tv/ChristianGeekCentral. The marathon's going to feature a wide variety of games from consoles past and present. I've already been kind of making my list and kind of a rough plan for what types of games I'll play when throughout the 24 hours. So yeah, it's going to feature a bunch of different games from consoles past and present, also possibly a mental breakdown during the last
2 to 3 hours. A new feature of the stream this year, guys, is my +2 page of many topics, which I will periodically roll dice and look at to decide what I should blab about next. You can leave your topic suggestion in the comments to this podcast or email me at paeter@spiritblade.com, and I may just blab about your topic during the stream. Controversial and complex or pointless and strange, all suggestions are welcome, so please send those my way. So to learn more about this event, join our team, or donate, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com, guys. That's where you'll find... I've also put like a thermometer-type thing up there so you can get a sense of where we're at in our fundraising. I think we are, as of this recording, last time I checked earlier today, at $95 out of the total $500 that the team as a whole is aiming for. I think that's very doable. There are five of us on the team. That's $100 per person. And if we get new people added to the team, that $500 goal is locked in. So, I mean, if you want to join, that will just only increase our odds of not only reaching that goal, but freaking crushing it, which is what I would love to see happen. More info about all this business, ChristianGeekCentral.com.
At last, the power of the dragon amulet is mine. It overwhelms your feeble defenses. You will now agree with all of my opinions and everything I say, even if it sounds stupid and wrong.
The Last Witch Hunter, starring Vin Diesel. The modern world holds many secrets, Lionsgate Films tells us, but the most astounding secret of all is that witches still live among us, vicious supernatural creatures intent on unleashing the Black Death upon the world. Armies of witch hunters battled the unnatural enemy across the globe for centuries, including Calder, a valiant warrior who managed to slay the all-powerful Queen Witch. I think they call her Witch Queen in the movie, decimating her followers in the process. In the moments right before her death, the Queen curses Calder with her own immortality, forever separating him from his beloved wife and daughter in the afterlife. That wasn't terribly clear watching the movie, but thank you, Lionsgate, for clarifying that. Today, Calder is the only one of his kind remaining and has spent centuries hunting down rogue witches, all the while yearning for his long-lost loved ones. And there's a big evil that's surfacing that I think the rest of the Lionsgate description just spoils a little bit that I won't say anything about. I'm a big fan of dark fantasy. I really enjoyed Solomon Kane. If you haven't seen that one, it came in and out of American theaters really fast. But if you like dark fantasy, that's one I'd recommend. So I jump at any chance for a halfway serious adult fantasy movie, since mostly we get fantasy for families and kids these days. The pacing in this movie is pretty good during easily the first half, I think. It's got cool and sometimes briefly startling action sequences that blend action and horror in a nice way. The story's not deep or original. You're not going to feel like, wow, this is going in directions I never would have imagined, you know. But it does scratch that dark fantasy itch for much of the movie, at least in my experience. The main character, played by Vin Diesel, named Calder, has some welcome backstory that helps me to care about him a little bit, which is nice, and I think that's really important because in this movie, Calder is invincible. Like, he's cursed with immortality. And so, when you've got a guy that you can't kill, you've got to find a way to give him things that make things happen to him that are going to cost him something. So the tension could potentially be robbed by this power, but for much of the movie, they provide tension through placing those around him in danger and also calling back to this tragedy of his immortality, which has caused him to live on beyond the life of his wife and daughter. Now, that story, although I did appreciate it, was a little bit confusing, because they would keep going back to these flashbacks of him, dreams, flashbacks, that kind of thing, of him, like, interacting with his daughter and his wife. And his daughter was a little girl, and she always stayed the same age in all of these flashbacks, which made me think, did his wife and daughter die shortly after he got his immortality, or what? And I always felt like there was going to be something more revealed, something more haunting, that like they had a tragic, their lives were tragically cut short. but they never reveal anything there. So maybe you won't feel the same way if you watch this movie, but for me, I was like, I was waiting for something more to be revealed, more tragic to be revealed, that would kind of define his separation from his family and how that came about. You know, if it was just because they died of old age, I think they should have advanced some of those flashbacks and showed his daughter getting older and watch him, you know, be with his daughter at the end of her life as she died of old age or something like that. It was just a little bit strange. I felt like there was something missing in that backstory, which really would have been welcome to have more of that expanded on and you know, show how it affects him emotionally to be separated from them by time and immortality. In the last 30 minutes, the dialogue, I thought, got extra cliche. I mean, it's cliche before that, but I mean, in the last 30 minutes, they kind of kicked it up a couple notches. And also more artificial and kind of movie-like. And one character suddenly just soldiers on for the rest of the movie after getting pinned to the wall on freaking rebar. And if I'm like, if this person can, like, pull themselves off of rebar and just kind of, like, grunt and tough it out for the rest of the movie, that just sucks all the tension out of the remaining action sequences in which this character is potentially vulnerable, because I just saw them pull themselves off of rebar and not go to the hospital. So I'm like, man, you know, so the last 30 minutes, which had, you know, of course, more action and more visual effects and stuff like that, were the least intense for me, because I was like, well, that person just pulled themselves off of rebar. They're going to be fine. You know? The cast, fairly uninteresting performances, but I mean, they were all fine. And Vin Diesel has some surprisingly sympathetic moments for me with his tragic dad / family history. Again, there were some things missing, I felt, in that backstory that I think would have been nice to have. But still, there were definitely some sympathetic moments that I appreciated. And I don't think it demanded much of him as a performer, but he did provide something that was useful in making me feel a little bit for him. The stunts and the visuals, cool visuals, you know, cool action and stuff like that, despite not being groundbreaking by any means. Magic in this movie is very visually present. So if you prefer light shows in your magic, which I do, over like Jedi force dueling, like in the Star Wars movies when they're just like looking at each other and doing this, or like in the freaking Lord of the Rings movies. Love those movies, but Peter Jackson decided he wanted to make them Jedis instead of wizards who would actually, like, throw around purple lightning. That's what I want to see, man. Freaking purple lightning. Well, you get your purple lightning, not literally, but you get all kinds of dazzly, cool, magical stuff in this movie. So if you like that in your magic in movies, then there's a lot to enjoy going on here. Let's see here. What else? The magic and spells often hint at mysterious underlying concepts. And what I mean by that is when a witch uses a portal to get from one place to another, it's not just like a portal that opens up and they step through it and then they end up somewhere else. No, it's like this gaping maw that opens up in the floor or the wall and a bunch of vines and branches and, you know, tendrils come out and suck them in to take them to their destination. It's just like, whoa, that is weird, you know? So very creative in the way that magic looks and behaves in this movie. It's a lot of fun to watch. The visual design and treatment of magic places it more, I would say, on the and I guess when I say visual design, I'm talking more about like costumes and the way they treat magic as a subject, puts it a little bit more on the realistic side of the spectrum compared to like Harry Potter, who, you know, has a few things that they pull from real world witchcraft, but I mean, by and large, it's this whimsical, fantastical kind of thing, and witchcraft here is pulling more from, I would say, the trappings of real world witchcraft, as we would call it. But there's still tons of fantastic visuals and other trappings that evoke classic fantasy over, you know, modern real world witchcraft. So it's, you know, it's not like this really serious treatment, realistic quote unquote treatment of real world witchcraft, you know. Let's see here. But speaking of that witchcraft, you know, is there anything in this movie that's potentially going to spark worthwhile thought or conversation regarding spiritual matters, moral issues, or anything like that? Well, I think that, you know, the witchcraft and the magic, you know, is potentially going to spark some thought or conversation in this movie. It's brought up that there are two different types of magic. There's elemental magic, and that's neutral, you know, so that's like fire, you know, or like it's like gasoline. It's like, you know, I don't want to say gasoline's not a natural element, but I mean, it's basically like this neutral kind of thing, you know, like a gun that can be used to defend somebody or to go out and viciously kill somebody, you know, or a rock that can be used to build a house or to you know, knock somebody over the head. That's the way that most magic is treated in this. That's elemental magic, the most commonly used magic. It's not it's not from a dark source or something like that. It's just kind of like a natural phenomenon that witches by birth, because of like their descendant from some kind of like fantasy creature race or something that's a little unclear, are able to kind of take advantage and use these elemental abilities. But then there's also dark magic, which, although they don't get specific, is evidently pulling from a morally evil kind of source of some kind. And at one point, someone with the dark gift brings up Salem. Now, I say dark gift because they don't intentionally draw from dark magic. It's just something that they were kind of born with or something. It's, again, very hazy on the details there. But, you know, Calder, the witch hunter, in response to this good witch bringing up Salem, you know, he says Salem was wrong. You know, they were wrong. Those women were not witches, and that shouldn't have happened. And the good witch says, but, you know, what if that would have been me? I am a real witch. Should they have killed me, you know, or would they still kill me, you know? And so that might bring to mind the question, you know, should we still burn witches? Should we ever have burned witches? I would say no. I don't think biblically burning witches specifically it was ever called for. But we do see in Exodus 22:18, at least in the ESV, it reads, "You shall not permit a sorceress to live." And most people know the old King James version, which says, "You shall not suffer a witch to live." And then Leviticus 20:27 in the ESV says, "A man or a woman who is a medium or a necromancer shall surely be put to death. They shall be stoned with stones. Their blood shall be upon them." Well, I think some things to recognize that I think we often don't in, you know, our popular culture understanding of these commands is that they were specifically for the nation of Israel and were binding specifically during the years after they had come out of Egypt and before Christ came. For that specific time, for those specific people. Now, for more on why I've concluded that these laws applied at one time but don't apply to us now, I'm going to try and remember to put some links below so that you guys can check out from an archived page that I did a kind of a three-part series on, like, Christians and our relationship to Old Testament law today, and why I have the views that I do, which I'm not alone in, you know, but they are the views that I hold. So if you want more info on that topic, I'll try to put some links below here for you. Even so, I think these laws were good laws serving a good purpose. Why? Well, for starters, Israel had willingly chosen to commit themselves in a unique and exclusive relationship with Yahweh, that's God's personal name as we see it in the Bible. If someone wanted to explore sorcery and consider it as an alternative to life under Yahweh, well, that's a tragic thing, but they had the freedom to leave Israel in peace and live in a neighboring country where they could pursue their exploration of witchcraft or necromancy or whatever. Israel was not commanded to go out and hunt down sorcerers wherever they were. They just weren't allowed to harbor them in a nation that was, by definition, dedicated exclusively to Yahweh. There was a point in Exodus, you know, where all the Israel, as they were coming out of Egypt, they said, you know what, we will bind ourselves to you. We will obey all that you tell us to do. That's who we are. That's what we're going to be about. They had willingly expressed that to Yahweh. And so he said, okay, then this is what that looks like. You know, if we're going to do this and you're going to be a part of this, and this nation is going to be more than just a man-made government, it is going to be something that is specifically dedicated to me and to me bringing you into my way of life. So is that intolerant or egotistical on God's part to command that for those that had willingly committed themselves to him? And even so, isn't the death penalty a little bit extreme? Well, YouTube movie reviews are a horrible medium for attempting to cover that topic. That's why, you know, I think that there's so many things, so many problems. That's like a whole different video I could do on, you know, how so often, you know, we kind of will watch, you know, commentary on topics that are really deep and weighty, but, you know, they're limited to a certain time because people don't want to watch videos that are more than X amount of minutes or whatever. And so, like, how can we really think that we are exhaustively probing and dealing with an issue when all we're doing is just watching, you know, we're seeing tweets and 10-minute videos or something, which this is going to go longer than 10 minutes already. So anyway, this medium is just not equipped for this kind of thing. But that's not me dodging the bullet. What I would say is that because there's so much background info that has to be covered in order to delve into that, for now I will just highly recommend, let's see, where is it? A book called Is God a Moral Monster by Dr. Paul Copan. If you have if you've ever had thoughts about, like, you know, the seeming extreme nature of the Old Testament laws, or like the violence in the Old Testament, or some of the strange things that God commanded in the Old Testament, you're just like, how is God good in light of all this weirdness and all this violence and all these other things? This is a great book I would highly recommend. That's going to give you the historical context and get into actually the Bible text and the Hebrew and what some of these phrases meant that are very different from what we think when we just look at them at a surface glance and like, oh yeah, well, this must mean this because in my 21st century mind, this is what it means. So surely it meant the same thing a few thousand years ago. So anyway, it's a great book to get into all that kind of stuff. Is God a Moral Monster by Dr. Paul Copan. So this movie, it's rated PG-13 for sequences of fantasy, violence, and frightening images. Now, I have no idea what your tastes are, so I'll just travel back in time if I can and talk to myself in the past. Pater. This is a Redbox movie for you, my friend. It might really scratch that itch that Solomon Kane did for a little while at the beginning, and you might think it'll keep doing that through the whole movie, but the last 30 minutes are going to feel robbed of all excitement for you. So Redbox it on a night where you got nothing else to do. I don't really like numbers, but I mean, if you like numbers, how about 7.5 out of 10? That's a C letter grade, so it's, you know, not a bad movie. It's just kind of, yeah, all right, yeah, there it is. And how about an 8 out of 10 for relevance? That's a B letter grade. I do think that there's some stuff to talk about if you want to get into it, but you do kind of have to want to get into it. It doesn't demand conversation or thought on these issues, but I think it's pretty easy to go there if you want to.
Data collection complete. Activating MusaNet 1.0.
I want to remind you guys about the videos going on at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral this week. You can see my Crimson Peak review, my Last Witch Hunter review, and also two videos that are totally different content from what you've heard here. And that's my continuing series of the retro game stream that I did over the summer. I kind of sliced and diced that up into the what I thought were the interesting bits. And I'm releasing it all in installments. Each video is about maybe 10 minutes long or so, shorter than my normal videos. The first one is Pater Plays and Sings Batman, the NES game from 1989. And the second one that went up this week, which I think is part four in the series as a whole, is Pater Plays and Sings Bionic Commando. Freaking catchy tunes in that generation of consoles. So if you want to hear my special rendition of those songs as I play, you can get that at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral. And why not like, share, and subscribe while you're there? That'll help us hopefully grow this community, get some more people engaged with what we're all doing together. As a reminder, guys, I want your voice and your interest to be a part of this podcast, part of Christian Geek Central. Whether you've got an idea for a segment already or you just want to be a part of the fun somehow, we want to find a way to plug you in and let your voice be heard. It's also a great way to promote what you're doing. If you'd like, for more info, email me at PAETER@spiritblade.com.
Incoming transmission.
Hey, Pater, John Wilkerson here. Probably some lawn equipment going on in the background here. Sorry about that, but I'm outside enjoying the beautiful fall weather here in upstate New York. Hey, there's a bird. Man, you have really been doing a great job in recent weeks podcasting. Loving the topics. Loving the In Search of Truth segments, that's for sure. And I just want to say, keep up the great work. I'm going to see what I can do for Extra Life with me and my one arm here. But we'll see if I can get a group of folks together and maybe we can raise some funds for you. Anyway, that's it. I'm just kind of running my mouth right now. So I hope you are doing great with the podcast. Keep your chin up, and dude, finish part three of Spirit Blade so you can finish Pilgrim's Progress. That's what I'm talking about. Bye.
Thank you so much, John. Really, all of your messages are so encouraging and usually come at a great time for me, so thank you very much. for responding to whatever prompting the Holy Spirit might have put on you and sending some encouragement my way. I also appreciate the feedback on In Search of Truth. I know, guys, it's been slow going, especially since hitting chapter 11. You know, we're going back and digging into the Old Testament to reference, you know, to get the background on each of these little examples, these heroes of faith, as it were, in Hebrews chapter 11. So I know we're suddenly crawling through Hebrews as we go through chapter 11. I do think the pace will pick up again once we're through all these, this huge list of examples that the author of Hebrews wants to share with us. I just want to make sure that that we miss out on as little as possible compared to the original readers of this letter, who would have had a background in you know, the Tanakh, the Old Testament, and they would have been able to call to mind much more readily the background of these different instances and people that that the author of Hebrews is mentioning. So I appreciate your patience if that's felt like it's been going kind of slow for you. And there's, you might have noticed that there's no In Search of Truth segment this week. I was close to finishing, but I was just a little pressed for time, and I didn't want to rush that segment. I never want to do that. But since I was close to finishing, we should be back in Hebrews next week, or the show after that, if next week's show gets too big. There's going to be a good amount of content, I suspect, on next week's show, so we'll just kind of see how that plays out. Also, John, is your arm okay? I'm sorry to hear that you only have one functioning right now, is what it sounded like. Hopefully that's nothing too serious. Thank you, though, very much for your willingness to potentially get involved in Extra Life. A hangout with some friends sounds like an awesome way to raise a few bucks, and every bit is really helpful. I mean, seriously, we've set a modest goal of $500, modest because that's only $100 or less per team member, and as I record this, we're at $95 of our total goal. And that's a solid start, but we could really use some more help, and if a lot of people give just a little, I think we can both reach and shatter that goal. It doesn't take much. It just takes something with something like this. So thanks for looking into that possibility with your friends. I hope it comes together for you and you have a great time. And thanks also for remembering and caring about Pilgrim's Progress. I'm very excited to get back to work on that. You know, I see the light at the end of the tunnel now for Spirit Blader World of Shadows, and I've, for the last year and a half, been already thinking about how I'm going to dive back into and approach production on the rest of the Pilgrim's Progress series. I think after the initial casting and recording of that, I'm going to do all the casting and recording of the entire series of Pilgrim's Progress. I'm going to write the entire rest of the script. I'm going to do all the casting and all the recording, and then once that's done, which I'm hoping that won't take, the writing and casting and stuff won't take longer than 6 to 9 months, then I'm planning on just getting into mixing. And if the production schedule for the original episode of Pilgrim's Progress is any indicator, at that point, they're probably going to release about 3 to 4 months apart until the whole thing is done. Because Pilgrim's Progress, I think it is going to tend to be a little bit more simplistic in terms of sound design, because there's not as much kind of like frenetic action and stuff as you would find peppered throughout the Spirit Blade trilogy. And there's no songs either, which take a boatload of time. It's a little bit more talking, not a ton. I mean, but I mean, you know, if you've listened to the first episode, then you have an idea of kind of what the pace is like. And, you know, a couple people talking while they're walking down a road with maybe just a little magical sound effect here and there takes a lot less time to put together than some of these really elaborate kind of action combat weirdness sequences from the Spirit Blade trilogy. So yeah, I'm very excited to get back into that. I'm very excited for the satisfaction that's going to have a much shorter turnaround time before I, you know, release something. It is hard. It is hard to work on something for so long and then only have that one experience of releasing it into the wild and letting people enjoy it. Yeah, I'll be ready to be done when I'm done with the World of Shadows. Anyway, guys, so thank you for that, John. Feedback, guys, give me your thoughts. I want to hear from all of you. Give me your thoughts on this podcast, Christian Geek Central, the YouTube channel, anything else we're doing. What should we keep? What should we change? Or what's on your mind, like a potentially uninformed opinion on? We want to make this show and all of Christian Geek Central just as fun and as useful as we can. But we got to hear from you to do that, to know what's fun for you, what's useful for you. You can send me an email at paeter@spiritblade.com. All right, that's it, guys. guys, stay tuned for Farscape Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 310 if you want to start from the beginning. Next week, if God wants it to happen, I'll talk about the Supergirl premiere, which I'm looking forward to. And then I'm also planning on doing a first five review of Divinity Original Sin Enhanced Edition, which is releasing on consoles this coming Tuesday. And I may possibly be sharing some reactions to Sony's Paris Games Week announcements. Their big conference is this coming Tuesday. I think it's 9 a.m. Pacific. Very excited for that. There's supposed to be some big news, and you know, I'm sure there's going to be some big news. The only big news I really care, not the only big news, backwards compatibility, I'd still love that. That's not going to happen because they have their whole streaming service that they want to convince themselves people want and will pay money for, so they're probably going to keep trying to make that purchase worth it, that investment worthwhile. Good luck, Sony. No, what I'd really like is for them to drop the bomb that, boom, No Man's Sky, available now. But I have the sinking feeling that it's going to be delayed until Sony PlayStation VR comes out, and it'll be a launch title for that, as well as, you know, regular console players, which would be really disappointing. But oh my gosh, if they drop a bomb on Tuesday of No Man's Sky, available now, man, then I'm going to have two freaking video games to try and put together, both video trial and error segments for the YouTube channel and first five reviews for this podcast. My week will be insane if that happens, but it would be an insanity I like a lot, so we'll see what happens. Till then, check out SpiritBlade.com and Christian Geek Central for more stuff made just for you. Thank you so much for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week and that you'll join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground Podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Frampton with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.com. Thank you for listening.
Prepare for immediate starburst.
All right, just finished up.
Episode 408 of Farscape Season 4. I shrink, therefore I am. Now, the last episode was John Quixote, and my memories of this one were foggy. I thought it was kind of another silly episode, and so I actually have been off of watching Farscape for about another 2 weeks. But now I think I'm going to get back on. I'm excited. I had forgotten that I actually enjoyed this episode. I think that my first impression of Season 4 when I watched it has just kind of stayed with me. And so I'm surprised when I come back to episodes of Season 4 and discover that I like them more than I remember liking them. And this is definitely one of those. What I remember about this episode is, okay, this is the one where the big tough aliens come on board, and they're mercenaries working for the peacekeepers, and they have a shrinking device that can shrink members of the crew and put them in little canisters, and they put those canisters in their chests because they're basically these kind of pumpkin aliens with pumpkin innards, so they have to stay encased in their humanoid-looking armor. Anyway, which is kind of cool and gory and squishy, and you know, so I mean, you know, lots of those kinds of Farscape aesthetics that I like in this episode. But I had forgotten about some of the great bits in this episode. One of the first ones is this is the first time where Scorpius now is out of his cell on Moya, because when the bad guys came on board, they're kind of like a one-shot alien. John calls them Cylons. Remember, this was on before the new Battlestar Galactica came on TV. And so you have to think back to what Cylons looked like in the 80s show to get John's joke and kind of how these guys look compared to Cylons. And they do. I mean, they're these big hulking guys, and they have these red, you know, obviously, you know, Christmas light type, you know, lights or for eyes. They don't like run back and forth like Knight Rider in the old Cylons, but they do kind of have a little pulsing quality. They're slightly in the higher side of the head, and they have kind of a horizontal look to them a little bit, even though it's two eyes instead of just kind of like one, you know, slot or something. What, I don't know what I'm getting at, but anyway, you can see that vibe, and you can see, you know, what John is responding to, and it makes me wonder, you know, if that was a Ben Browder
thing, or if they like told the creature shop, make something that kind of feels like Cylons, because that's what's in the script here, is that he makes fun of them for looking a little bit like Cylons, you know. Anyway, but there's this, you know, Scorpius is out of his cell, and so because he wanted to be useful, and because, you know, so before the bad guys discovered that they had Scorpius in one of their cells, he escaped, and apparently he could have done this at any time. So he's really trying to build up John's trust at this point, and apparently has been since he got on Moya, as he has apparently willfully been staying in his cell, you know, and up to this point, as if I remember correctly, you know, his conversations with John are like, John, must you persist in this? I mean, you need to trust me that I am here for your good, you know, and really, you know, there was no point. If that's his main concern, is he wants to get John to trust him, then there was no point, no reason for him to break out of his cell before this. So I can actually believe that, yeah, this guy, he's just been sitting in his cell. There's no point. What was he going to do? Break out and just start wreaking havoc and take over? That's not what he was there for. He was there. He's been trying to gain John's trust, you know. So I thought that was cool. And so we see kind of a trust exercise taking place as Scorpius and John, for the first time, are having to work together against another enemy. You know, in more of like an action buddy, you know, cop, you know, movie, buddy cop movie kind of thing. And there's that great moment where, you know, he's given Scorpius a weapon, and then he ducks around the corner, and Scorpius charges up the weapon when the bad guy comes around the corner, and the weapon fizzles out. Because it wasn't loaded. And he just kind of like relaxes his action pose and looks over at John and says, "Thank you, John." And then gets shot by the bad guy. That is one of those great Farscape moments. One of my favorite and most memorable moments of the whole series, I think, but certainly of this season. You know, it's just... I laughed so hard when I saw that, and still gets a chuckle out of me every single time I see it. What else was going on in this episode? I mean, the shrinking thing was not as big a part of the episode as I remember it being. And the reason that I you know, don't remember liking this episode is because I don't really like the whole shrinking concept, this whole shrinking sci-fi concept. You know, to me, I associate that with silly things like The Incredible Shrinking Woman, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, you know, even Ant-Man, which was really kind of an attempt at taking that concept seriously, that sci-fi concept seriously, shrinking somebody. It was still, you know, a Marvel-type comedy thing. It wasn't like totally taken seriously. I've never seen that kind of thing taken seriously, and I don't know, I think it's just kind of like talking and intelligent animals and apes to me. It's silly to me. It's not cool. It's not threatening. It's not empowering. I don't think of someone as, I mean, I should think of them as especially vulnerable when they're shrunk down, but I mean, I don't know. It doesn't do anything for me. It's like a concept that you see in like, you know, a kid's sci-fi show on the Disney Channel or something, you know, not like in serious sci-fi that has weighty drama. You know, there's just something kind of silly about it, you know? And this wasn't a weighty, I mean, can you imagine the whole shrinking thing working in a weighty, dramatic episode of Farscape? I can't. I mean, but having said that, if any show could do it, it would be Farscape, of course, right? I love the way that this episode starts, because there's a couple things that just kind of like, again, they really require you to have been invested in the show. Like, when they notice that, you know, the way they communicate, the way that Pilot communicates that something's wrong, you know, to John without giving away that, you know, he's at gunpoint, is he describes everyone on the crew doing things they would never do. And we as an audience know, right along with John, oh my gosh, seriously, Dargo would never be doing that. Oh, Chiana and what's-her-face, they're not, it wouldn't be getting along. Rigel isn't hungry, are you kidding me? You know, and so we know these things, and so it's a payoff for us as the viewer just in the very beginning. Of course, if you're a new viewer to the show, you're hosed at that point. You don't understand what's going on. I mean, I get why this show struggled, but we take it for granted now. This show, I don't think, for the reasons it struggled back then, it would not struggle now because of Hulu and because of, you know, on-demand, you know, viewing. It just wouldn't struggle now, which is why I really would love to see this reboot that's in the works happen, because, man, now is the time for this show. But I'll get to my thoughts on what I would want, you know, for the reboot when we get to the end of the series. Oh, yeah, there was another little throwaway line. Like when John was trying to figure out what was going wrong, Pilot was describing all these weird things, you know? He said something about maybe we're still in the game or blah, 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 maybe this or maybe that. But he threw that up, maybe we're still in the game. That's the previous episode, John Quixote. They carried over just this one little line that carried over from before. It was great. I just love that kind of stuff. It's like this story in some ways it never ends, you know. It's not in the same way that shows would today. Like, you know, The Walking Dead is much more continuity heavy, I think, from episode to episode, you know. But for its time, you know, and I think that's one of the reasons why it holds up so well is because we're now more used to that and more demanding. Our shows have that, this really heavy continuity type style. Wouldn't that be cool to see a Star Trek reboot when they're done doing these movies? To see like a Star Trek show made with today's sensibilities instead of the sensibilities of the 60s and the 90s, you know, under which the previous TV shows were made, you know? It wouldn't have to be, you know, like the movies and, you know, basically just be a Farscape Battlestar kind of clone, you know, but it would just be neat for them to realize, hey, every episode doesn't have to be self-contained. There'd be so much more potential for character growth. I would be very interested in watching a Star Trek like that. Anyway, I don't want to go long just to go long. I actually got in the mood to watch this episode because I've started playing Dragon Age Origins again, and Claudia Black plays one of the main... She does the voices for one of the main characters in that game. And so I was like, you know, I think I'm ready for some more Farscape. So, and I'm really glad that I did. I'm really glad I got back into it. And next episode, a prefect murder. Definitely more serious than this episode. That might be kind of a weird episode. I'm trying to remember. I don't know. It's kind of cool to forget as much as I have. So it'll be some surprises for me as well.